So this morning we're going to begin to think about walking with Jesus and what that actually means for us in practice. I want to tell you a little bit about the health app that I've got on my phone, on my mobile. And it's an app that I really loved it. I was absolutely delighted with it when Bex, my daughter, uploaded it for me last year. But you can go off apps, can't you? And this app, it records the average number of steps that I take every day. And I was able to set a target back in 2018. I was able to set a target, and I set a target of 10,000 steps that I was going to try and walk on average every day. And most days I managed it, and I felt really pleased, and I felt really much healthier as a result of it. But then at the end of December last year, end of December 2019, I got a message, because it gives you a little message, a little summative message every so often. And this was the message. We'll see it in two parts. Your average steps per day for December was 926. And then it went on to say, this is 92% less than the same period last year. And I thought, great, because this message from this inanimate computer program, it felt like a bit of a telling off. Yeah? It felt like a bit of an accusation, as if the app on my phone was accusing me of having become some sort of a couch potato. I've gone sort of from hero to zero, doing all those 10,000 steps, 926 on average. And I kind of thought, doesn't it know that I'm on crutches and I can't? Well, of course it doesn't. It doesn't know any of that. And so that was the message I got. And I want to tell you that the fight back has begun. And here it is. The fight back began on the 3rd of January. You'd be really pleased about this. 3rd of January, and began in the most unlikely of places, in Aldborough. Here's the picture. There we are. I've been at one of those special lookout towers in Aldborough. And Ange and I went to Aldborough, and we had some lunch there. And before lunch, we did a walk. And after lunch, we did a walk. And then I looked on my phone eagerly to see how many steps I'd done. You see, I haven't got rid of the app. And I'd done 5,300. Do you know, I felt really good about that. Last year, 2018, that would have been no good at all. But I thought, good, this is the fight back. And do you know, what was even better was that we met some friends, some old and dear friends, folks who I used to teach with at Thomas Mills High School many years ago. They met us for lunch in Aldborough, and they went walking with us. And we hadn't seen them for nearly a year. We hadn't seen them since Hannah and Ben's wedding, as it happened. And so as we walked with them, so we talked and we shared, and there was so much news and there was so much to get excited about and to find out about and to catch up on. And that's the picture I want to bring to you this morning. Walking with Jesus. Imagine us walking with the Joneses. That's our friends on the 3rd of January in Aldborough, and sharing with them and keeping in step with them. And it was wonderful, and it really was a way of sort of rekindling and developing that relationship and that friendship with them. And that's what it means to walk with Jesus. This is a wonderful ambition, isn't it? As we're quite near the beginning of a new year, second Sunday of 2020, one of the things that Terry pointed out that we're going to pray for particularly today and this afternoon is our walk with Jesus. And I kind of found myself wondering, if I had an app, you know, if you could get an app on your phone that measured your walk with Jesus, I wonder what my app would be saying about that. And as we commence our new series this morning on walking with Jesus, I've got just two questions for you. Both of them are from Jesus himself. They're both very direct. You know that Jesus could be very direct. And they were both, in a sense, posed as Jesus shared the Last Supper. We're going to share in communion together later in this service. But as Jesus shared the Last Supper, his last meal before he went to the cross, he talked to his disciples at some length. We're looking at those, at what he had to say on Sunday evenings at the moment. But can you imagine Jesus sat at the supper table with his disciples, and he looks round at them around the table. I think we've got a picture of Jesus. He looks round and he says to them, "Do you really love me?" Well, that's effectively what he said. We read it. He says, "If you love me." And I know you'll say to me, "Paul, that's not a question. That's a conditional clause, a conditional statement." And of course it is. But it's a question really, isn't it? If. That if introduces perhaps an element of uncertainty. And it's as if Jesus is saying to each of them as he looks around the table, "Do you really love me?" Do you know, I think that the disciples might well have felt quite hurt by that if. Can you imagine them sitting there thinking, "Lord, haven't we left our work to follow you over the past 3 years? Haven't we left our families? Haven't we left our homes? Haven't we given up our normal lives to go out on the road with you? We've literally been walking with you for the past 3 years, and yet you say, if." It's almost as if you're asking us whether we really love you. I want to say that Jesus brings that same question to each one of us this morning. Do you really love me? And I can imagine somebody in the congregation sort of saying, "Whoa, hang on a minute, Paul. That's a big jump. Surely that's stretching it a bit." You see, I'm a historian. I've always found the stories of people in the past really fascinating. The words they spoke, the things they wrote, the things they did. I'm going to show you, we're going to see on the screen the pictures of four of my historical heroes. There we go. Right, little test for you. Who'd like to name any of my... These are my particular folks who I admire. Anybody like, just shout out, feel free. We've got, thank you, along at the end there, unmistakable. We've got Winston, haven't we, in a typical Winston pose. I do admire him very greatly as one of the great leaders of this country. Anybody like to name another one for us? Who else have we got? It gets Queen Elizabeth I. Yep, that's right. And a woman in a man's world back in the 16th century, but just amazing in her leadership of the country over so many years. The other two are perhaps a bit difficult. I've gone a bit Celtic with the first one, but somebody will be able to tell us. Robert the Bruce, excellent. Yeah, Linda, I knew you wouldn't let us down. Robert the Bruce, one of my great here. I'm fascinated by Robert the Bruce. My law surname comes from Scotland originally. I don't know if that's part of it, but Robert the Bruce. And who's the other one? Next to last, anybody? It's the hardest one. Abolition of the slave trade. William Wilberforce, there we go. William Wilberforce. Perhaps it's not a very good likeness of him. I don't really know. But those people, they're sort of four of my great heroes. I can't get enough of them. I love reading about them, finding out more. But supposing I said to you, I love Robert the Bruce. Or I love Queen Elizabeth I. I guess you'd probably assume I meant I loved studying them. But if you thought I really meant it, you'd be sending for the men in white coats, wouldn't you? You'd think, well, my goodness. And yet, I'm here this morning to tell you that I love Jesus and to say to you that he asks this question to each of us. Do you really love me? And you might well say, how can I love a figure of history? Somebody might well think that this morning. Perhaps you wouldn't be perhaps too polite to ask the question open, but how can you possibly love a figure of history? And Jesus, of course, he is a figure of history. He was born in Bethlehem in the reign of the Emperor Caesar Augustus, and we were celebrating that just 2 or 3 weeks ago. But Jesus is more than a figure of history. The central claim of the Christian faith is this, that Jesus conquered death. We sang that a little while ago. Worthy is the one who conquered the grave. He was put to death by the Romans, put to death under Governor Pontius Pilate. Friends took his body down from the cross and buried his body in a rock tomb. And there was no doubt that he was dead. It was real. But 3 days later, he returned to life. And when the authorities investigated, they found that the tomb was empty and the body of Jesus had gone. And in the weeks that followed, Jesus appeared again and again at different places, in different places and on different occasions. He appeared to his close followers. You remember, even doubting Thomas, who thought it was all a great tall story and a load of wishful thinking, he met the risen Jesus and he came to faith. So as we saw with the children in our messages this morning, Jesus rose from the dead and he is alive forevermore. And therefore, it is possible to know him. It is possible to love him. It is possible to walk with him in the 21st century. And yet I think you might still say to me, but Paul, it's not that easy. Even so, even if all that is true, it's still not that easy because Jesus isn't physically present with us as he was with those first disciples. I remember many years ago in a conversation, a friend saying to me this, Paul, how can you possibly expect me to love someone when I can't see him or touch him or hear him with these ears? And you know, the answer to that question is found in the reading that we had this morning from the Gospel of John. As Jesus shares that last meal with his disciples, he's preparing them in all kinds of ways for the fact that he's going to leave them. And he's already warned them about that, hasn't he? Over and over again, Jesus has warned them that he's going to be put on trial, that he's going to be arrested, he's going to be put on trial, he's going to be killed. And yet it never really seems to have penetrated the disciples' consciousness. They were in denial, if you like. They couldn't quite bring themselves to accept. It was just too painful, really, to think about. And they know that they'll just be lost without him. And they're troubled as they sit round the supper table. It should have been a joyful time sharing Passover together, and yet they're troubled and they're anxious. And then Jesus gives them this wonderful promise that we read together this morning. He says, I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. And that's exactly what happened, wasn't it? Jesus left them, as it were, through the cross, through his death. But then in the weeks that followed, he came to them. Didn't leave them as orphans. He came to them again and again, and he appeared to them as the risen Lord. And their hearts were warmed, their spirits were lifted, their faith was rekindled. And yet, I have to say this to you, incredibly, it wasn't enough. Because by their nature, you think about those resurrection appearances, they were fleeting, weren't they? Jesus appeared. And then he disappeared. Then he left them again. And you know, I think for them it was like being lost and left on their own all over again. That's very much part of the human condition, isn't it? You think of an occasion where sometimes perhaps it's with your children or with someone else, and you've been separated for a long time. And then you get to meet up. Maybe at Christmas time, you know, you met up with folks in your family who you haven't seen for a long time. Or maybe it's folks in your family who live overseas and you only get to visit them from time to time. And it's lovely. When you meet them, you embrace them and you're together. It's wonderful. But do you know that feeling? The inner sense from that moment that you meet them, the clock is ticking, isn't it? Because you know the time will come when you have to travel back home, or they have to travel back home. And you're going to go through that pain of saying goodbye again. And the promise that Jesus makes here, this is a wonderful promise. The promise that Jesus makes to his followers here is that as far as he's concerned, there will be no more goodbyes. Because he goes on to say this, I will ask the Father and he will send you another counselor. I think in our reading it was advocate, but another counselor to be with you forever. And these two promises that we've got on the screen, they're Two sides of the same coin. I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. And the Father's going to send you another counselor, the Holy Spirit, and he's going to be with you forever. And that promise, of course, was fulfilled spectacularly, wonderfully, on the day of Pentecost. Jesus had come back. No longer did he have the limitations of a physical body. He was with them always, everywhere. And it's really important. If you're a Christian this morning, we need to remind ourselves about that, don't we? That it's gloriously true that Jesus is here with us in church this morning, that he's with you, he dwells within you by his Spirit. If you're a Christian, if you're a believer, he's with you in those tough moments at work. He's with you in those times of ill health. He's with you in your darkest hour. And I understand that perhaps for some people here this morning, the idea that Jesus is present with us, although invisible, is hard to grasp. But the truth is this, that in our modern world, we build so much of our lives on things that we can't really see or know or understand. You remember just before Christmas, I was telling the children about useful presents and exciting presents. Well, I'm pleased to tell you that I had a good selection of both. I did have some socks, but I also had some exciting presents. This one was really one of the ones that's excited me most. Ange gave me this. And it's called Sea Shaken Houses. And it was exciting because I didn't even know the book existed, but it was just a perfect book for me. It's all about rock lighthouses, lighthouses that are built on rocks far out to sea all around the United Kingdom, just like the one you may have been wondering in the last few minutes. And I put it up there just to perhaps get you thinking. There's one of those rock lighthouses. That's the Wolf. Just the top of it, because that's what it's like around the Wolf Rock Lighthouse, 8 miles off the coast of Cornwall, right out in the Atlantic, and it's often subject to these terrible, terrible storms. I'm well over halfway through this book at the moment. I've always been fascinated by the sea, and I've always loved the Cornish lighthouses, long ships just off Land's End, Bishop's Rock, the one that's just off the Scilly Isles, but above all, the Wolf Rock. This was the most unpopular posting for lighthouse keepers back in the day when they had to have keepers in the lighthouses because you couldn't land a boat on the Wolf. The only way the keepers were ever relieved, they had to be taken off by breeches boy across the raging sea into the boat. And sometimes it was months on end that they'd be stuck in the lighthouse waiting for the relief to come. But you know, building these lighthouses and manning these lighthouses, it was a great challenge. But perhaps the greatest challenge of all was to put a light inside these lighthouses that would actually be useful and would help sailors to avoid the jagged and the dangerous rocks. And to begin with, of course, they used candles. So we see the first Eddystone lighthouse now. This is one of the first ones built. There we go. It's a really peculiar looking structure. And it had candles, we'll see that, 24 of them all together in a great chandelier. I think we've got the picture with great chandelier, and it had reflectors to sort of magnify the light. And you might think, gosh, 24 candles, that's going to be absolutely useless. But you know, so bright with the reflectors was this light from the Eddystone that people 8 or 9 miles away on the Hoe in Plymouth, on the seashore in Plymouth, were able to look out to sea, and they saw the lighting of the Eddystone Lighthouse, and there was a big round of applause. And it wasn't long before candles were replaced by oil lamps called argand lamps. And then a scientist was appointed by the Trinity House in charge of the lighthouses, and he said, why don't we use electricity, this new stuff called electricity, in order to provide a powerful beam. And you know, the people in charge said, no, that'll never work. And they carried on for nearly 100 years using the oil lamps. There were various reasons. There were technical reasons, but mainly because they said, no, this electric, we don't quite understand it. We can't see it. We don't know how it works. And they didn't want it. They thought it would be too difficult. But do you know, when eventually, and you've got a picture there of a electrically powered lighthouse and the beam coming out. When eventually, in the 20th century, they did put electricity into the lighthouses, the beam was so powerful that it took people's breath away. One watcher said it was as if a new star had arisen in the sky. Do you know, that's exactly what happens when a person becomes a Christian. If you're sort of, as it were, hesitating on the brink of coming to Jesus, look at this amazing verse. This is what the Apostle Paul says happens when someone becomes a Christian. He says, "For the God who said, 'Let there be light in the darkness,' has made this light shine in our hearts." I think we've got the verse to come up on the screen there. "Has made this light shine in our hearts." That's the one. "So we could know the glory of God that is seen in the face of Jesus Christ." God who said, "Let there be light," right at the beginning of creation. Imagine that. Imagine that light. The light that came from God's word. That same wonderful act happens when a person becomes a Christian. We're lit up from the inside. That's the amazing miracle that takes place. The light that shines inside a Christian, it's not physical, it can't be seen by physical sight, but it's evident. How are we going to show Jesus, the reality of Jesus, to people around us? It's evident in a changed life. And although we can't see Jesus or touch him or hear him with our physical sense, it is possible for each of us to walk with Jesus day by day. And as we do so, to make him visible to those around us. And so very quickly and quite briefly now, our second question from Jesus. First question was, do you really love me? And I think that's a really important question for each of us at the beginning or near the beginning of a new year. And the second question, will you keep in step with me? You see, my friend, Steve Jones, who I met up with on the 3rd of January over in Alborough, he's a very tall man with very long legs. And usually when we go walking, he sets off at a tremendous stride, and I'm sort of walking very fast and trying to try and keep up with him, you know, keep in step with Steve. But when we were in Alborough on this occasion, it was a different story. And I was walking along on my crutches. And so what happened? Steve adjusted. He didn't go surging on ahead because he'd have been out of sight, wouldn't he? Very, very quickly. He adjusted his step. He kept in step with me. And that's exactly what it means to walk with Jesus. It means to keep in step. The Apostle Paul makes that really clear. He says this, "Since we live by the Spirit," Spirit of Jesus, "since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit." And Jesus makes exactly the same point at the supper table. He says, we read it together, "If you love me, you will obey my commands." You'll keep in step with me in your life. It's a wonderful link here, isn't there, between love and obedience. I love this. Think of all the great leaders. I was talking to you about historical leaders, and the four I picked out, I think, were, obviously, they had their flaws, definitely, but they were wonderful people in many, many ways. But down through history, there have been a huge range of terrible tyrants and dictators. How many leaders through history have ruled by fear and hatred? A tremendous number. People have followed them because they've been scared not to do anything else. And how many have ruled by deceit and lies? Again, an enormous number. What's the power that binds Jesus' kingdom together? It's the power of love. The essential motivating force of the kingdom is love. It's love that shines out like a sort of stellar lighthouse beam in a dark world. And as in the weeks that lie ahead, as we unpack the topic of walking with Jesus, we're going to see exactly what it means. A lot of the talks really are about what it means in practice to keep in step with Jesus. And this morning, as we come to a close of the talk, I just want to focus on two central commands which Jesus gave. And the first one, we can see it in the picture there, it's the command we read about in the Gospel of Matthew. to be baptized. One of the really important things that Jesus commanded and was certainly taught by the early church, repent and be baptized. Perhaps this morning you're a Christian, but you've not been baptized. Well, we're very much hoping that in the weeks to come, we know that Charlie's going to be baptized, and we're absolutely thrilled and we're delighted about that at some point in this year, in the early part, hopefully, of this year. But if you think, well, the Lord's been speaking to me about baptism. I am a Christian, but I've never been baptized. Why not have a chat with one of us, perhaps with Andrew or with Terry or with myself or one of the other leaders, and just begin to find out what baptism involves? And we would be so delighted to prepare you, as it were, for your own baptism, because that act of getting baptized is a very specific way. I mean, there's all sorts of ways in which we can obey Jesus, and he will guide us and he will give us commands in our own lives. But a command that's sort of foundational for every Christian: get baptized. Follow me into the waters of baptism. And do you know what happens when somebody gets baptized? They make the invisible visible. They show the truth of Jesus crucified and buried and then raised again as they go under the water and as they come up from under the water. And then there's a second command, and it's very appropriate that we should mention it this morning as we're coming around the Lord's table. And Jesus gave this command, of course, during the Last Supper. He looked around the table again and he said, we read this in Luke in chapter 22, another account of Jesus at the supper table, and he said, I have eagerly desired to share this meal with you before I suffer. I've just been looking forward to it so much. There's something special, isn't there, about sharing a meal. I think probably that quote's on our next slide. My younger daughter, Hannah and Ben, her husband, they've been in New Zealand on honeymoon over the Christmas period. And so although we were able to Skype them or FaceTime them or whatever it was on Christmas Day, we couldn't actually be with them in that way. And they're coming to us next weekend, and so are the rest of the family. We're going to sort of share a kind of belated Law Christmas together next weekend. We're looking forward to it. We're looking forward to that special sharing meal time together with the family. And Jesus looked forward to that meal with his disciples. But I want to tell you something amazing this morning. Jesus looks forward to us coming together around the Lord's table and sharing in bread and wine. If you're a believer, you can bring joy to the heart of Jesus this morning as you obey that special command. If you're a believer, if you're walking with Jesus, take the bread and take the wine, and as you do so, say thank you in your heart. And Jesus, who is in a sense invisible, will become visible, become known to you through the communion, through the breaking of bread. Because as we take the bread, we're obeying the command of Jesus, who said this: take, eat, this is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And Paul develops that in a wonderful way in 1 Corinthians 11. He says that whenever we share in communion, as we're going to do this morning, he says that we are proclaiming, or we are showing, the Lord's death. We're showing the truth again about the sacrifice of Calvary. Showing it to each other, showing it perhaps to anyone who's here who's not yet come to Christ, showing it in a sense to a watching world. As we take communion, we are showing the truth about Jesus, who died and who rose again and who lives forever.